Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I am O'Brien McMahon, and this is People Business. In this episode, I'm joined by Paul Falcone. Paul is a best-selling author and top-rated presenter and storyteller who specializes in workplace leadership, development, communication, and talent management, including effective hiring, performance achievement, employee accountability, and workplace ethics. Drawing from his years of experience as head of HR for Nickelodeon, head of international HR for Paramount Pictures, and head of HR operations for NBCU's primetime and late night lineups, Paul knows how to entertain and train meaningful concepts for quick and easy adaptation and implementation. He's a memorable presenter who imparts leadership wisdom and practical step-by-step actions for immediate mastery and same-day implementation. In this conversation, we sort of skip through a couple of Paul's 17 books on business and leadership and HR. We talk about tough conversations. We talk about leadership offense and leadership defense, which is an interesting topic to think about. We talk about leaders as coaches and a host of other things, measuring KBIs instead of KPIs, really broad-ranging conversation on how to be a better leader, how to create a better, happier, healthier team, and most important to he and I, reducing drama. It was really fun. I think there's a ton in here for anyone who is a leader, whether you're an HR leader or otherwise. And so I hope you enjoy it. One thing I will note, Paul forgot to mention it in the show, but he splits his time between LA and Chicago. He loves connecting with people to continue these conversations and talk through these issues in person. So if anybody is interested in reaching out to him who live in LA or who live in Chicago, would encourage you to go to his LinkedIn and send him a direct message. Likewise, if you are ever interested in connecting with me on these topics, I enjoy talking through them as well. Feel free to look me up on LinkedIn, send me a direct message. Always love to engage with listeners and hear what is resonating with them, what they're struggling with, and how I can be helpful. That's it. Here is Paul Falcone. Paul, welcome to the show, or I'll kind of say welcome back to the show, a little peek behind the curtain. We had actually started this during a storm and you had lost power. So we're back for round two here to try to get something, a full conversation in for the audience. So welcome back.
We'll get it right this time. Don't you worry, O'Brien.
There we go. Cool. Everything's plugged in. Internet should be working. We're good.
True.
So let's just sort of start at the beginning. I like to kind of set the table a little bit. If you could just give the background on your career and how it is that you came to write 17 business books.
Yeah. So I'm a career HR person. I worked in healthcare. I worked in financial services. People mostly know me from my entertainment experience. I was head of HR for Nickelodeon, head of international HR for Paramount Pictures. And I think that's how people associate me. But I always had parallel lives, so to speak. I was writing on the side. And the companies where I've worked have always been very supportive. So part of it was I was a columnist for SHRM, the Society for Human Resource Management, but I was also writing books for the American Management Association. Their book publishing division is called Amicom Books. And in 2018, HarperCollins bought Amicom Books. And so they created a new imprint called HarperCollins Leadership. And number 17 comes out in May, in just about 2 months. So really exciting.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations. What made you want to write books in the first place? You know, it's a big undertaking to organize your thoughts in that fashion and write a book, let alone 17 of them. So where's that coming from?
Sure. So for me, it was interesting. I went to high school in New York City. I grew up in New York, and I was about three blocks from the original Barnes & Noble. And The first time I went in to their flagship store, I was overwhelmed. I always loved libraries as a kid, but in the Barnes & Noble, I looked around, my eyes were totally wide open. I was like, I don't know, one day I want to write a book. I have no idea what it's going to be on. Flash forward, when I went to college, I ended up getting my bachelor's and master's degrees in literature. I had no idea what I was going to do with it. But as I got into the business world and found my way into human resources, I wanted to try my hand at publishing an article. And so the first article hit. It was from SHRM. It was called Personnel News. Doesn't exist anymore, but I got my first article published. I couldn't believe it. I slept with it under my pillow. Then the American Management Association had a magazine called HR Focus. Doesn't exist anymore. but I started writing for them. And before you knew it, I had about a dozen articles written with AMA, and I knew they had a book publishing division. So I asked my editor, if I put together a proposal, would you mind sharing it with the people on the book side of the house? And they did. And long story short, in 1994, January of 94, there was the big Northridge earthquake. And we were hit pretty hard in Southern California, where we live. We're just about 20 miles from Northridge. The funny thing is, we didn't get mail for about 7 days. Still cleaning out the kitchen with the shovel and doing all that stuff. The first mail run came, they loaded our mailbox with stuff. And in that was my acceptance letter from AMA saying, congratulations, we're publishing your first book. I'll never forget it. It just changed my life. So it was great stuff.
And this might seem like a weird question, but I like writing. And, you know, a lot of HR people always say, oh man, I could write a book with the experiences I've had, or 17 of them. What was your process for writing and working at the same time? Were you able to combine those two?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I was also teaching at UCLA Extension, School of Business and Management, in the HR certification program. And so what would happen was, things happened in the workplace that I thought, you know what, I want to kind of write about this tonight because I think I could fix this. But I can fix it on paper because it didn't go great. It didn't go as well as it could have in reality. Then I'd go talk about it at class. One night a week, I would teach. It was like a 3-hour class. The students would come up with the same questions and the same problems. That would feed yet more articles. And so I had this kind of system for creating articles. And before you knew it, I had so many articles, I had enough content for a book. And that's really what paid it forward for me. People will be like, where do you come up with all the content? And I'd say, believe me, I am not that creative. But it finds you when you're in human resources. So that's why when people say, man, I could write a book, they're not kidding. I think all of us have a book in us if we wanted to go that route, because there's so much stuff that people do in the workplace that leave you scratching your head sometimes, but there's a lot of content. And there's a lot of things that you can do to turn what maybe wasn't a positive situation into something more positive, or at least share the things that were working well.
Yeah. Well, I love the daily capture of that, that, you know, eventually enough daily capture turns into quite a bit of content. Have you ever heard of a commonplace book?
I don't think so.
So various authors have used it in the past. It's just the concept of having a place, either a physical bin, or I kind of do it through Evernote now, where when you hear stories or quotes or facts that you think are really interesting that could be relevant, you just have somewhere that you file them away under certain topics. And so then when you want to go write something, you can actually sit down and look at the different categories that you've got. You can sift through all the notes that you've got. And who is it? Ryan Holiday, who writes, he's written a lot about stoicism and Daily Stoic and that kind of thing. He uses that for his books. I know there's a great video, if you Google that, where he keeps a bin of note cards of all the different things. And so he'll actually create his chapters in note cards first with all his research. And then just one at a time, he'll pick them out and write them.
Isn't that interesting? Well, the funny thing, okay, so that's a good point. I had a shoebox in college when I was building my vocabulary with the little index cards. I think it's the same kind of idea.
Yeah.
But the funny thing for me was, I always wanted to focus on the how. I know that people knew what to do. They honestly didn't know how to do it. So whether it was like a book on having tough conversations with employees, or motivating and growing your team and coaching them, or what questions to ask in an interview if it's a recent college grad versus an attorney, versus a senior executive, versus a salesperson. To me, it always focused on the how. And what I didn't realize at the time is, you know, I kind of filled a niche or gap, so to speak, with my writing, because in a lot of cases, even if you have an MBA from a top 10 school, they don't teach leadership in the trenches. You got to figure that out on your own. And I'm not saying it's wrong to make experience your best advisor and all this stuff, but you're going to step in a lot of landmines all along the way. And it's better if we can sit around the campfire, so to speak, and pass the wisdom from the elder generation to the younger generation to say, hey, this is kind of what my experience was like. Filter it through your own, but here's some approaches that might help you. And here's what it sounds like, or here's what it looks like in writing, or whatever it happens to be. So that was always kind of the way I approached my books, and knock on wood, they've done fairly well over the years. So I'm real fortunate about that.
Yeah. Well, let's dive in a little bit. And rather than pick one out and go deep into it, I thought it might be kind of a good format to skip across the surface of some of these and you know, maybe dive in a little bit. The one that you had said has resonated the most with audiences is 101 Tough Conversations. What is it about that book that you think has resonated so much?
It's 101 Tough Conversations to Have with Employees. And the subtitle is A Manager's Guide to Performance, Conduct, and Disciplinary Challenges. The path of least resistance is avoidance. So in my experience, O'Brien, dealing with how many clients, internal clients, at the various companies where I've worked over 30 plus years, they don't want to open the can of worms. It's too hard. And so they cut a wide swath around the person. They look the other way. They sweep it under the rug. And then they come into my office. They want the person gone because some proverbial straw was broken on the camel's back. Of course, I open the personnel file. I've got nothing but glowing performance reviews, no progressive discipline. And now I'm the bad guy because I'm not letting them terminate.
Yep.
So what I did, what I learned early on was when I go into a new company, the first thing I set up is management training because I need them to understand how to think like me. And that's exactly how I, it's like, you guys, I want you to filter this through me as if you're me to understand how I'm going to do this and what I'm holding you all accountable for as the senior leaders and department heads and blah, blah, blah. So that part of it worked best for me. And in that book, my basic premise is, look, yeah, tough conversations are not meant to be easy, but if you can do it in the employee's best interest, if you make it see what's in it for them, if you could talk to them about maybe they're having a perception problem, it's not something they're doing intentionally, but in the eyes of the receivers, it's not coming across as well, or even opening up that conversation with the top sales producer who's month after month the best producer, but they're a toxic person to work with and everyone cuts a wide swath around them. Having a conversation that says, you know, the most important decisions in your career are going to be made when you're not in the room. That's the same for you as it is for me, as it is for everyone else. And there's something that may be missing awareness that could hold you back over the long term. I'd like to talk to you about that because it's something that I think is in your ultimate career best interest. And I think it's going to help us here on the team as well. No one's in a defensive mode. No one feels like they're being judged. They don't feel like, you know, you're pointing your moral finger at them saying, ooh, you always do this or you never do that. It's none of that stuff. There's no drama in it.
Yeah.
I always say, don't come from judgment, come from observation, but you have a right to observe and share what it feels like from your vantage point or your perspective. And map that over performance problems, conduct problems, attendance problems, whatever you want to do. That approach, I think, is what made the book, you know, fairly consistent out there. I mean, knock on wood, that book has done very, very well because there's not that many books out there that map out these scripts. And the final thought on that to me, O'Brien, is I don't tell people, you know, use these words. I don't. I'll say, listen, this is how I phrase it. And sometimes I inject humor in it or sometimes whatever. Make it your own. But you should be able to hear what that conversation sounds like before you ever walk in the room and know what that person's probably going to respond like. And how you maybe can overcome that and what to be prepared for. That's the kind of thing that I wanted to get across in the book. So
yeah. I've done a lot of sales training and you know, you do role plays and the coach or the trainer will say, you know, here's what you say. And everybody, and myself included when I used to do it, everybody who tries to go verbatim on whatever the script is always sounds terrible. But if you can internalize the concept or the mindset that you're in and apply the principle in your own words, that always seemed to be better. So I like that advice of like, hey, there's some examples there so you can see it, but don't feel like that's the way you have to do it necessarily.
Well, it's kind of like telling people how to raise their kids. I can't tell you how to talk to your children. I don't know you. I don't know your kids. I don't know your parenting philosophy. I don't know how you were parented. What I can say is, here's an example of how I spoke to my son or daughter about it. This is how they responded. Now that you've heard the whole conversation through a couple of rounds of, but what about this, Dad? And what about that? And blah, 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 blah. You can kind of you can conceptualize it. You can capture it in your understanding, and therefore you can make it your own in your approach.
Yeah,
so it's got to have that flexibility built in, to your point.
For sure. For sure. And that's where like reading, I think to your point of putting a couple examples in there and letting people see context, then now they can sort of process a couple different views of it. One of the other things that I like about what you said is walking in with the right mindset. I think mindset is such a huge part of how a conversation goes. We, again, back to the sales training we've done, we talk about how you can say the same words, but if you go into a sales conversation with, I need this person to buy something, they're going to feel it. It's going to feel icky. They're going to feel pressured. But if you go in and you say, I don't need anything, I'm just here to help this person, it's going to feel better because you are there to help and they can feel that, no matter, even if the words are similar. We talk in a leadership group I'm in about giving feedback from a place of belief. About if you don't believe, if you can't see a path forward for that person, you shouldn't have the tough conversation. How does that, that kind of sounds like what you're saying.
Yeah, I'll take it a step further though. It's like, if you don't believe in the person to the degree that you should have the tough conversation with them, they probably don't belong on the team. And I don't say that from a judgmental standpoint, but sometimes that's your tough conversation. The example in the book is how to hold that kind of conversation when there's no progressive discipline on file, when you've got no written record, but you want the person to not be there. And so the reality is this, I'm careful about not coming from judgment. I want to come from observation. I also believe that you get a lot more managing people's strengths than you do trying to shore up their weaknesses. But you got to have both employment offense and employment defense, so to speak. It's like, you know, no team is going to work if they've got the greatest offense in the world, but they don't have the defense working for them. The defense is knowing how to hold the tough conversations. It's about accountability. It's know how to structure progressive disciplinary documentation and, you know, that'll withstand legal scrutiny because you may end up having to terminate. Not everyone is ready to be successful on your team. And so sometimes I think people feel like, well, if you would just motivate them a little more. And it's like, believe me, I've tried to motivate. But there are certain cases, and this is not the majority. It's a little more on the rare side, but it's still there that people don't necessarily really work in the environment. And being able to say something to them so that they'll listen to it always takes me back to what I learned in the second grade. It's not what you say. It's how you say it.
Yeah.
And if you, to your point, if you say it in a way, O'Brien, that comes across as sincere and it's real. And it's like, Paul, I don't know if this is the best opportunity for you. I'll be honest with you. I know we haven't gone through this road of progressive discipline and we could do that, but I don't see this being a place where you're happy.
Yeah.
And I'll share with you, I'm not happy either. I don't think you're really comfortable here for a number of reasons that we've discussed. And if you want to talk about some options to make a graceful exit, I'll be happy to have your back on that. I mean, maybe it's you saying, I would rather resign, but I want to craft the message to tell everyone why I'm leaving and I'll give 2 weeks notice. Or maybe you want to start a quiet job search and it's okay. I'm happy for you to do that. Just give me 24 hours notice, but within a reasonable period of time, probably no longer than 90 days. If you haven't found anything, I would expect you to step down at that point. But even in writing that stuff and putting these little scripts together for even those really uncomfortable situations, the thing too, O'Brien, is what I'll tell the employers, and I'm trying to be in the book, kind of their coach and mentor, is you've got to put something in documented form. You've got to have some leverage in the game. If you have no documentation on file, that 60 or 90 day window can come up and the employee can say, well, I didn't find anything and, well, I'm not leaving.
Yeah.
And now you're stuck because you wasted 90 days and you'd done nothing to build progressive discipline around the problems that were there. So you can't promise them the 90 days. You can tell them, listen, I'm going to try to, but you've got to uphold your end of the bargain. Still, the fact that we're at this point, I need to put something in a documented form because based on your performance and your conduct to a degree, I think there is a net negative effect on the organization. And so we need to move in that direction.
Yeah.
I'm still here to support you, but you need to understand I need to do that. Having that kind of conversation is like, it's totally transparent. And I think even though no one likes hearing a message like that, they still feel like, look, at least he's being honest. I don't have to divine by his actions whether he likes me or not. I'm putting it out there.
Yeah.
And I think people can respect that and they can move on in a healthy way and it lets them heal. When ultimately they're gone from that organization, they can heal from that. And it's not like, you know, lawsuit is a tool of workplace revenge, right? They feel like they were humiliated, stripped of their dignity when they were most vulnerable. And the way they get back is by trying to sue a company. If you treat them with respect, they're not going to do that. Most human beings wouldn't respond that way. Certainly I wouldn't. So.
Yeah. Well, I think about that email too, like putting it in writing. I've heard the suggestion of putting it in writing just to make sure that everybody heard the same thing. You know, less of, hey, I'm going to have to put this in writing now so it's official, and more just saying, hey, I'm going to follow up with you with a summary of what I've said here so that we both have it. I want to make sure that you have heard it, can reference it again if you need to, or even having the person respond back and say, hey, can you email me back when you get back to your desk of what you heard in this conversation? so that we're both on the same page. And then if they don't come back with what was said or the improvements that they're going to make, then you can go back and put that in writing and say, no, it's actually this. So I've heard using it as kind of part of the development process, as well as then also having written record.
Yeah, the idea of the same day summary kind of captures what you've all agreed on. And I think that's a great idea, but you have to start the process.
Yeah.
I've seen employers who've been the good guy and, you know, I told them or I told her, giving them 60 days or 90 days. And at the end of that period, they're like, well, I didn't find anything. So I'm just going to keep looking. Yeah, but you told me you would step down. Well, I can't do it. I'm not in a financial situation to do it. And now the employer's frustrated because it's like, you know what? I didn't even start the process when I should have. So you've got to kind of have some leverage in the game. And I think that really helps. Even when negotiating a separation package with someone, a lot of times if you don't have something in writing as leverage, you're betting against yourself.
Yeah.
Right? We've seen these situations where employers are like, well, Paul, we'll give you 3 months to sign this release. I don't like doing that. I've never done that. I don't pay for terminations. I don't do that. But I've also seen in situations, or at least I've heard about it as a teacher, where it's like the employer's like, well, I don't want 3 months. I want 12 months. And then they try and negotiate from there. And you have no leverage in the game at all. Because if they don't leave, you're stuck. And if they do leave, they can go to a lawyer and say constructive discharge. And you know what? They were forcing me out. And they offered me a package. I didn't accept it. But blah, 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 blah. It just creates drama. One of the most important things to me in all of my writing, and seriously, what I tell my employees, O'Brien, I've always told them in my career, I'm a consultant now. About a year and a half ago, I left corporate behind and I'm doing my own stuff. But the funny thing is I told every one of my teams, here are like my big eight or my big 10 values. I've written on that. I call it values-based leadership. I live my values every day, but my number 10, the last one is always no drama.
Yeah.
I don't do drama. I had a lot of it as a kid. I don't like it as an adult, and I've gotten away from it in my life. So I want everyone to understand that that's a really, really important tenet for me, that to be successful on my team, that's a key issue.
You and me both. I always say I'm allergic to drama. I can like feel my body have a reaction when things start to go too much. I say my wife, we've gotten some common language now where she'll come home. Everybody has to vent, right? Everybody vents. I vent. She vents. And she would be venting. And then all of a sudden I'd have this kind of, not physically violent, but I would have this sort of like eruptive response. And she was like, well, where did that come from?
Yeah.
And what I figured out was the point where it turns from venting into stewing, I can feel it physically happen in my body. And that, and then it starts to wear on me. And then that was causing the eruption. And so now we've worked on our communication to the point where she'll vent, or she'll do it, call me on it sometimes too, where, you know, one of us will be venting. And then all of a sudden it's like, are we stewing? Are we circling the drain? Or are we still, why don't you take a minute, get whatever else off your chest you have to get off, and then let's wrap this up. And the other person always goes, yep, you're right. We're at that point.
Yeah.
I've said what I need to say and we move on. So that's an aside, but I agree with you. I don't like drama.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah.
One of the things that hits me as you're talking about these difficult conversations, I mean, we've talked about the difficult one of having to offboard people, but if you have difficult conversations early, you presumably most of the time don't have to get to that point. So how can leaders develop a good cadence around this stuff so that people are getting this kind of regular feedback and it's just part of the process? It's not something that hits them out of the blue. Because I think part of what can be tough is that it's going to catch somebody by surprise versus if you can create frequency around it, it almost make it easier for everybody. At least that's kind of the thought that occurred to me as you were talking.
You hit the nail on the head. I mean, everything that I'm writing about these days, and it's consistent with the literature. If you're reading these Harvard Business Review books and all these other things on performance management and team development and everything else, the two keys are number one, real-time feedback. And number two, formal windows to capture one-on-one time. I tended to do that historically every quarter. I kind of follow the Wall Street thing, right? You have the quarterly reports, the 10Qs that result in the annual 10K report. That made sense to me. Some companies, some managers do it monthly. However you want to do it is fine. Don't do it once a year. The business world changes so quickly that the old paradigm of once a year we do performance reviews in our company makes everybody nervous, and they get hives. They get itchy, right? You get this physical, like, the employees don't want to go hear it because they feel like they're being judged. The managers don't want to do it because they feel like it's confrontational. Path of least resistance is avoidance. So they inflate the grades because they don't want to have to deal with the drama, right? So grade inflation becomes a problem everywhere. And that's historically what it was. Now, when you looked at the annual performance review historically, they talked 80 to 90% about past performance, which made people feel judged. And thanks for telling me now on my annual review when you could have told me at the time.
6 months ago, yeah.
Right? And you're lucky if it gave 10 to 20% to talk about your goals and your future. When you're doing A, real-time feedback, with B, these quarterly development meetings, then when you get to the annual review, you'll end up really speaking maybe 20 to 30% about past performance because you're just capturing what you talked about throughout the year. And 70% talking about their future. And that's really what an annual review is supposed to be about. When you look at Gen Y and Gen Z, the millennials, the 45 and under crowd, Gen Y, the Zoomers, the 25 and under crowd, Gen Z, these are the most studied generational cohorts in world history. And the funny thing, O'Brien, is we know everything about them that we could possibly want to know. And survey after survey, they keep coming back with top three, top five things that are so important to them. And number one at that list, on the list, every time is career and professional development. Well, what does that mean? Well, number one, it means recognition for a job well done. You have a lot of managers who tell themselves these stupid narratives, excuse me, well, you can't recognize them. They're going to want more money. They're going to want a promotion, which is silliness, but a lot of people think that, unfortunately.
Sure. Yeah.
And then the other thing is, it's not just about recognition and real-time feedback. It's also about helping them course correct and learn their craft, and learn their trade, and learn their business. That's what they need. If they feel like they're in that learning curve, they're not going anywhere for 20%. Okay, I got a 20% offer, but I love working for Paul Falcone. That's going to be what keeps them retained. But the two key issues are the relationship with their boss, number one, and the learning curve, number two. So yeah, you're making a mistake. You're not doing it the right way. How do I come about that as your leader? Am I sitting there and judging you? Am I saying, I can't believe you always do this and you never do? Or am I saying, wait. Let me ask you a question, O'Brien. Tell me about this. I know you were putting this forward, but share with me what you were thinking about at the time. Tell me the different things you were considering. Let me see if I can help a little bit in terms of my having worked in your job for a number of years, but let's talk about it. And that's what the coaching construct is. That leader as coach model is not judging them. It's not telling them what to do. You're not giving them a fish. You're teaching them how to fish. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that you're still not a manager. I mean, you're still giving answers to questions in an operational context. I get that. But when the opportunities come, it just screams, this is a great chance to really help that person learn and think like you. I've always told the people on my team, my job is to get you to replace me one day. I want you to understand what it looks like from my vantage point. And I want for you what you want for you, regardless of what it is, even if it means leaving this company at some point, because we can't grow you to the point you want to be. Hear me again. I want for you what you want for you. It is not, I want for you what I want for me through you. There's a really, really big difference, right? And they can tell when that's authenticity. This is it. It's transparency. It's full disclosure. There's no drama. I mean, I like these people. My job is to help shepherd them through their careers.
Yeah.
If someone left my company because they were a manager with me, but they got a director level job elsewhere, that's cause for celebration. I want everyone to celebrate that because they couldn't have gotten that director level job without having the management experience they had in my shop. On the flip side, if I've got someone who's at the analyst level who leaves to go become an analyst elsewhere, I got to scratch my head. I missed something and I need to talk with them and find out what was the miss on my part. So that's kind of how I look at it. But again, that's healthy turnover is celebrating. Yeah,
that's a great filter. We did an episode on here with the head of HR for Haircuttery. And we talked a lot about that in it because they can't really promote. There's like two positions that you can have in the whole organization if you're working in one of their stores. And so we talked a lot about how do you retain people when you can't promote them. And his big thing was, I want to help them get where they want to go. And if I can if they know that I'm helping develop them to move beyond our organization, they're likely to stay with our organization longer because they know they're getting what they need to get where they want to go. They don't have to, they don't get that anxiety that they need to go jump somewhere else to get it now.
Totally agree. Genius. Whoever that person was, I couldn't agree more. I've had very low turnover on my teams over the years.
Yeah.
And I'm fortunate about that. But I think the reason is, it's like, look, I like working for Paul. I feel like he has my back. I can trust what he says. And, you know, look, I can go somewhere else for 20%, but I don't know, what am I going to get? Someone who throws chairs and spits fire. I'm not sure I want to risk that. So when in doubt, stay here. I've always told my people too, look, if you're looking for another job, I'll be your reference. Ooh, in HR, you're not supposed to say that. Oh, baloney. I'm happy to do that. And I know how to do that. So it's like, you know, if they trust me, and if they don't, it's okay. I don't tell people, you must tell me. But it's like, I'm like, you guys, I'm here.
Yeah.
And where that transitions for me, which is interesting, O'Brien, I always tell them, guys, I want you to live the bullet, not the comma. The bullet is the achievements, the accomplishments. What can you link to increase revenue, decrease costs, save time, higher customer satisfaction? Don't come to me with, I do phones, comma, filing, comma, correspondence, comma. I don't care about commas. The comma is the basic job description. I want you people to leap tall buildings in a single bound. I want you to build your self-confidence. I want you to feel like you are so good at what you do, not to get cocky, but to feel that self-confidence that you can pay it forward and you've got a gift to give other people. And again, that's why I say values-based leadership. You're going to feel better as a leader if you can put your 5 or 10 top things on a piece of paper and share it with your team, because now you're living your values. And then you can encourage them to come back with their own values that they want to share. It's a great team meeting or monthly meeting or quarterly meeting or whatever you want to do. But those kinds of things are not silly. These work. And I've worked in environments with MD, PhDs in healthcare. I've done it with movie producers and directors. I mean, these are not the easiest environments. I mean, these are tougher environments. The bottom line is this: the people who report to me live in a microcosm. Okay, this is my world. I don't care what's going on above me. I don't care who the Hatfields are shooting at the McCoys, the bombs are going off, and all the drama is happening. My team is my ecosystem.
Yeah.
I create that culture on my team that I want, regardless of the noise, either above me or to the side of me. And that's kind of how I've looked at it. And that's what I try and capture in my writing.
I love it. And one other thing that kind of hit me, we spent a lot of time in our organization talking about the concept of flow and how you stay in flow. And from what I come to understand is that as you gain skill, you need to take on bigger challenges. And you can stay in flow when you are scaling the challenge just ahead of your current skill ability, so that it stays just hard enough that you need to really be focused and working on it. And it hit me when we were talking about hard conversations and regular conversations that if you're not having those, people can feel like, oh, this is easy. I'm doing what I need to be doing. This is easy. I'm good at this. And then you're not giving them harder things to do because you're not seeing them as being capable. And so they'll get bored thinking they can go be better somewhere else. And it almost... giving them that feedback almost keeps them in that flow zone because they know they need to stretch. They know there's more growth to happen. And it's like, it's actually almost a mechanism for keeping them in that flow curve.
Yeah. The saying is that people, high performers anyway, are going to stay as long as they feel like their career is on the right trajectory, right?
Yeah.
They're learning more. They're acquiring more. They're building muscle.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to tread water. The truth of the matter is, over COVID, over those 2 to 3 years of COVID, however you measure it, a lot of people out there were treading water career-wise. And when I launched my consulting firm, it was the summer of 2022. And one of the reasons I did it was we were coming out of COVID. We were moving into this post-COVID reintegration phase. And I thought companies are going to want to do a lot more management training and executive coaching and, you know, needing keynote speakers. I was like, so my timing was good. I've been busy, knock on wood. But the point is, life begins at the end of your comfort zone. If people start treading water in their jobs, basically they can do the work. It's not a matter of them not doing the work, but you can sense it. They don't go, they're not trying to do anything extra for their peers. They're not making a resource of themselves. They're kind of resistant to learning new things. That's a tough conversation.
Yeah.
Because in my shop, that's not going to work. I don't expect people to do that. even when I talk about performance management, and I've written books on performance appraisal, you know, the dreaded, the middle tier, the meets expectations. And everyone goes wild, like, oh, meets expectations, that's like a C in school. I'm killing myself and you're only giving me a C and all this stuff. But I always say, really, in your mind, when you go through the analysis of how do you align your people and how do you grade your people, you need a 3A and a 3B. The 3A meets expectations, and I don't say meets expectations, I don't like that, but fully successful. To be a 3A means they're trying, they're going out of their way, they're making a gift of themselves. They don't necessarily perform with distinction, but their hearts are in the right place and they're eager and blah, blah, blah. That's a 3A. A 3B means, yeah, they can do their job, but it's probably because of the tenure that they've had in their role. They can do the job in their sleep, but they're not willing to do anything above and beyond. Mm-hmm. Now I start separating it out. Now, when you look at your 3A people, can you move the middle of the bell curve? Can you take those people and move them up into the high profile group? And your 3B, you really have to decide, are they really not meeting expectations, or can you move them to the 3A group where they're really engaged again? But I don't want people sitting around going through the motions and living a comma life. That is not going to work for me. If they're not thinking about bullets on my team, I'm going to have a problem with that. I'm going to call them on it. So,
yeah. So let's talk about that. You've already teased sort of leaders as coaches. You've mentioned that already in here. And that was a question that I wanted to get into. What does it mean to be a good coach as a leader? How should people think about that?
When you think about, like, you know, the expression, happy cows make more milk, right?
Sure.
The third grader is always going to do his or her best work for their favorite teacher. I mean, it's just what happens. So I tell people, just look at it simply. Think about who your favorite boss was. And I do this at my UCLA class all the time. Tell me about your favorite boss. Don't tell me who it was or where, but describe what made that person the most inspirational leader you've ever had. And the hands go up. And one person, O'Brien, says, she always had my back. She had more confidence in me than I think I had in myself at the time, but she obviously saw something in me and I always appreciate that. Great. Next student. Well, he's someone who really valued education. It was because of him that I went back and got my AA degree. And he really made sure that I took advantage of those company benefits, blah, 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 blah. When you get through these examples, someone you trust, someone you respect, someone who you felt like had your back, someone made you feel included. I always say, are you describing the person's beingness or their doingness? Now, it's both. Mm-hmm. But are you describing who they are ultimately, or are you describing what they did? And it's so funny to watch this happen because I open it up and the first students raise their hand and say, well, what they did was what they did. Right. Okay. Keep talking about it, you guys. And they're talking and they're talking. And someone says, well, wait a second. I think it's who they are. It's who they are that triggers what they did. And there I say, aha, you just got the answer. There's not a right or wrong. Don't feel bad if you didn't come to that conclusion yourself. But the truth of the matter is, it's a lot easier to be someone's favorite boss by doing nothing. Doing this isn't the focus. It's how you made them feel. It's Maya Angelou saying, people will not remember what you said. They won't remember what you did, but they'll always remember how you made them feel.
Yeah.
And that's really the key to what coaching is all about too. Coaching is about asking the right questions. It's not giving them the fish. It's teaching them how to fish.
Yeah.
So I would tell, you know, we've all heard the thing about when you have a suggestion, come to me with three possible solutions that you've considered and tell me which one you recommend. That is the classic coaching construct. What I would tell them is, you guys, I'm going to tell you something that I learned when my daughter was 16, when I was the parent. And she would come to me and say, Dad, I don't know blah, 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 blah. And I'd say, I know you don't know, honey, but if you did know, what would the answer be? And she would look at me and she'd go running to her mother saying, Mom, he's doing it again. Okay, flash
That's
forward.
A great question.
I'm just telling you, Nina's 33 years old. To this day, she still says, Dad, I remember when you did that when I was 16 and it used to bug me to no end. But I'm glad you taught it to me because it made me realize I had the answers in myself. And the funny thing, in my experience, O'Brien, not just with the kids, with the employees, when you do that, I know you don't know, but if you did know, what would your answer be? 90% of the time, they give me the exact answer I was going to give them. Yeah. And in the 10% of the time when they're off a little bit, you just ask a couple of qualifying questions and you'll get them there, but they'll get there because they figured it out on their own. That's how you build leaders. That's how you build talent. That's what talent development is all about. So that's really the essence of what a coach does. A coach asks questions to get them to find the answers inside themselves and build self-confidence. And that's really the key. It's a self-confidence issue.
So let me dig into that a little bit. May or may not be facing this situation myself where I'm thinking about, and I fully buy into being the coach and try to do that. At the same time, when you're running really fast, it's really easy to go, we need to do this. If you can go make it look like this, that'd be great. And so how do you have that conversation? How do you guide somebody there when you know that this is a new skill set you're asking them to put in place, or it's something they've never done before? Where do you start? Like, how do you get them there when you kind of have to at some point show them what it looks like?
Yeah, great question. So my thought is, how do you make the space for it, first of all? To me, what seemed to work well is when I had one-on-ones, especially going through COVID, right? In COVID, we had to have one-on-ones with our direct reports because you had to carve out that time every week. You just had no choice. But then how do you do the weekly staff meetings? And are you doing anything on a biweekly basis or a monthly basis or a quarterly basis? And looking at, you know, how do we make sure, especially in a remote environment, that people feel like they're still connected to the mamaship, right? Yeah. That was a big part of it. It's in those one-on-ones that you can do this. I'm not saying in the middle of our busy days, we start, you know, talking to, okay, Paul, well, tell me what you, we're not going to have time for that. But the one-on-one is just that. It's the perfect opportunity to have these kinds of discussions. And when you talk to people about, look, from a career development standpoint, it's important to me that you soar here. I want you to thrive. And thrive is my keyword. My employees always knew that. Thrive is the word. But you're only going to thrive if you feel like, A, I have your back, B, you have a lot of self-confidence, and you feel like everybody else on the team supports you as well. So how do we make that happen for you? And how do you make that happen for everybody else? That's why I'm holding this meeting with you. That kind of discussion with someone, once they know where your values lie, once they know what's important to you, all the problems kind of disappear. They really do. All the little chitty, you know, blah, 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 behind the scenes, who's griping about this and the griping towel, and that stuff seems to melt away, at least in my experience. I don't mean to sound naive. Yeah. Yes, I'm sure there were things happening behind my back that I didn't know at times. But the reality is, peer pressure seems to fix that.
Yeah.
When they're all on the same page, they'll be like, hey, knock it off. I see what you're trying to do. Because people come to me, hey, Paul, just want to let you know. I talked to so-and-so and I told her she better knock it off. Because these things kind of realign themselves when it's a healthy environment. The opposite is when they talk about, you know, the toxic environment and how dysfunctional it can become. It's just like not going to happen in my world. I don't deal with it. I will fix it. I will call you on it. And believe me, I've written the book on how to document, discipline, and terminate. Now, I don't say that to people, but that's what I'm thinking in my mind. There's my self-confidence. It's like, if you think you're going to try and trick me out of this, you're not. I know how to do this. I wrote the book. And again, I'm not saying that people should have that necessary mindset, but you've got to have enough self-confidence to know that if you're challenged on it, you know where to go with it.
Yeah. What about for somebody where it's not...
Again, you know, that's the leadership defense piece of it.
Yeah. Well, what about when it's not somebody challenging you or something like that, but it's more a development opportunity for them, right? It's, hey, we want you to take this knowledge set that you have and we want you to start applying it this way, you know, but they don't, like, they're so stuck in their old way that they were doing things that it's hard for them to even visualize what that would be. Is it... show them how to do it once. Okay, hey, I'm going to show you how to do this one time, and then I want you to like apply it in future scenarios. Is it something like that? What does coaching look like to sort of get them across a bridge, you know, that they can't see?
So the most important word that I teach managers is the word perception. Perception isn't right or wrong, it just is. It's like feelings aren't right or wrong. They just are, right? And this idea of holding people accountable for their perception management, regardless of their intention, this is how it may be coming across. So I can talk to someone on my team and say, okay, perception-wise, can I share with you how it sometimes comes across to me? Sure, Paul. What are you going to say? Right? Sure, Paul. What's up? And I'll say, I sometimes feel that you're being resistant to these changes or any changes in general. Now, it's normal, and I'm not judging you for it, and I don't want you to feel bad for it. But if you think about changing your mindset just a little bit in terms of becoming the early adopter or at least trying to make these things flow with everything else that you're doing, I think that's going to be better for you and it's going to be better for me. Now, with this new assignment, I'm giving you this. It's a stretch assignment, right? But throughout this period of implementation, which I think is going to be about 30 days, I want to figure out how often you and I should meet to make sure that you're online, you're in sync, everything is aligned, that you're not feeling like, oh, I'm guessing here and I'm throwing you off the deep end. Because for the period of this implementation, you and I will work closely through this because I want to make sure not only are you successful at it, but that you become confident in it. Hmm. Now, when you have that conversation, that's a conversation that says, my boss is into this. I know I've got to deliver, but I've got a resource who's my champion who's going to help me do it. As opposed to Falcone, figure it out, see you Tuesday. Yeah. That doesn't work. And in a lot of companies, again, what I'll say, O'Brien, I feel like managers are pressed in so many different directions, right? They're individual contributors, they're managers. I'm not supposed to hold their hands, but you know, but you also have to be there for your employees as their boss to make it safe for them to do their very best work every day with peace of mind.
I love what you said there about it's not just I want you to be able to do this task. It's I want you to be able to repeat this with confidence in the future. Because that's like, that is putting in their court, not just checking something off the to-do list, but really mastering something. Like that's the expectation that they are going to master the thing. And that comes with a bunch of different motivations than just figuring it out the first time. You know, it's like, it's the difference between taking a test in college where you just can cram and off you go and you don't think about it again, versus having to apply whatever that skill is over and over and over again and really be a master of it. Right. So I love that. Just that little wording in a conversation, I think, could really have an impact on people.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it does. I mean, I always say, you be the average bear. Even as an executive coach now, because I'm doing that work, one of my first questions is, would you want to work for you?
No.
And I'm like, be honest. And they look at me and their eyes go up to the left. And they're like, you know, I mean, that's a hard question, Paul. I mean, I'm busy, right? And they start making excuses. But no, the seriousness. Yeah. My question is a follow-up question. If the whole company followed your lead in terms of behavior and conduct and everything else, would you be happy with where you took it? Those are not easy questions for people to answer, especially when, as an executive coach, what I'm learning is the problems are typically not with KPIs, key performance indicators. The problems are more with KBIs, key behavioral indicators. The reason they're getting the coach is because they're actually good performers, but they don't play nice with everybody else.
Yeah.
So they need a coach to soften them and help raise that emotional intelligence and awareness and everything else. But the bottom line is coaches help you see things for yourself. And I did that naturally for 30 years. So when I got certified as an executive coach, it was like, okay, this is fine, but it's horse sense to me. It made sense. It gave me a little bit more content to write articles and books. But the bottom line is it didn't teach me anything new because to me that just made logical sense. But helping them find it in themselves, that's how you become someone's favorite boss. Quick story. So the manager on my team at Nickelodeon went on to become the senior vice president of human resources at DreamWorks Animation. And I ran into her a year or two ago and she just said, it was in the mall. She was like, OMG, Paul Falcone. I still think WWPD, what would Paul do? You're the one who got me where I am in my career, blah, 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 blah. That's why we work. Yeah. Not for the paycheck, not for the benefits. Those are important, don't get me wrong. But I always say leadership is the greatest gift the workplace offers because it allows you to touch people's lives and build people's careers. What other opportunities do you have to do that? And what a great feeling to know that Ashley looks at her success in her career and she thinks back on me. That's it. I've touched someone's life. I made a difference.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the be all and the end all.
That's great. I love that. I got to ask you this question because you've said leadership defense a bunch of times already. What is leadership offense?
So leadership offense is growing talent. It's communication. It's team building. It's this idea of coaching. It's this idea of how do you make more leaders? You know, they think of Jack Welch at GE, General Electric. Remember, he was the guy who created all the CEOs who filled all the Fortune 500 companies. He knew how to grow CEO talent. That will always be his claim to fame. There were more corporate CEOs who came out of GE than anywhere else. I always wanted to have that same reputation, although I was doing it in an HR context, not in a context like Jack Welch. But the point is, the gift that you have to give is creating more leaders. That's what it is. It doesn't matter how many people report to you, whether it's 4 or 40 or 400. The bottom line is, are you able to develop talent? And what's happening now, and I write about this a lot because it's one of those things, O'Brien, that people aren't paying attention to. There are many, many changes happening globally. But because of demographics and all different kinds of shifts out there, talent scarcity is going to be with us for the rest of the century. This is not new to the pandemic or this post-pandemic period. This mm-hmm. is with us for the next 100 years. And so companies, oh, by the time you get to 2040, they're probably going to be focusing more on talent development than they are on talent acquisition. Not to take away from talent acquisition, but it doesn't mean that you're going to be able to run an ad on LinkedIn or Indeed or call a headhunter and get what you need. You're going to have to know how to grow your own. Yeah. And if you can get ahead of that curve now, boy, that's a gift. So if you can become known as, man, just get on Paul Falcone's team. He knows how to grow them. They all seem to be having fun. They produce very high results and they seem to thrive in their careers. That's your 30-second elevator pitch. Because yeah. they'll define you as a leader in terms of your ability to grow talent. And that's what to keep in mind.
I love it. Paul, this has been a fantastic conversation, and I think that is a perfect place to wrap this up. You are working with HR teams and corporations to implement all the stuff that you just talked about and a whole lot more. Where can people find you if they want to get a little bit more, potentially bring you in to help solve some of their problems?
Oh, that's very nice. Thanks. Yeah. O'Brien, what I would say is, first of all, if anyone wants to connect on LinkedIn, I'd love it. I'm just Paul Falcone 1. My website is paulfalconehr.com. And my books are on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and everywhere else. So that kind of thing. So thank you for asking. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And I would encourage people to reach out. I think when you listen to a podcast, it can seem like these are people kind of up in their ivory tower having this conversation. But I think one of the things that I try to do with this show is these are real tangible issues that people are really struggling with. And a lot of the guests who come on are really people who can help. And so like the thing I love is when I hear stories that somebody who was a guest was able to get some business and help somebody else solve that problem. So encourage people to reach out to Paul if you need that help. And you can find everything that he just mentioned in the show notes, wherever you're listening to this episode. So Paul, thank you. Everybody else, good luck improving your leadership, your coaching, and creating a team where your people are thriving.
Thanks, O'Brien. Appreciate it.
Hey, folks, one last thing before you go. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to hit subscribe so you can stay up to date with future guests. That's it. Thanks for coming. Go make the most of your business and the people in it.